Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, look, cartoons!
You can't rewrite history. Not one line.
They've got bubbles coming out of their mouths.
You must find out how that door opens.
That's one thing you mustn't do. Human beings can't go in. For our sakes, don't...
Pull to open.
Pull to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
Sounds all right, but I don't think we should take our eyes off those two for a second.
Oh, I shouldn't mind them. They're far too busy timing their miracle.
What miracle?
This is what's important.
Here come the drums!
Come the drums, here come the drums.
Hello, and welcome to Pull to Open, an ongoing quest to rewrite every line of history. No, to watch every story in the Doctor Who televisual canon in random order. My name is, randomly, Chris Taylor.
And I am concretely Pete Paschal. Every week, Chris and I make a little history ourselves by discussing a story from the collected works of Doctor Who. And for the past couple of weeks, it's been all about history. Changing history, not changing history, playing a lot of dress up when you go back in history, all those things. But before we get into where in history we are today, Chris, would you mind bringing the listeners up to speed on our journey so far?
I do not mind at all. Previously on Pull to Open, three stories ago, we were at a story where the Doctor was sacrificed. It was Gallifreyan sacrifice in Ark of Infinity. Two stories ago, we were looking at the evolution of a species and whether one should interfere in that evolution as they become humans, whether they could change things in full circle.
So you know, it's funny, the way you began the pitch to full circle, it actually sounds very close to evolution of the Daleks.
Yeah.
I just realized.
There was a lot of evolution in full circle, and there was a lot of attempted interference in human affairs last week in The Time Meddler, which was not the first Hartnell we've done. We went to Marco Polo.
We've done plenty of Hartnell.
Pure historical. We'd done the Censorites back in season one. But this was The Time Meddler, and it was, of course, about, guess what, meddling in time. And establishes the fact that you can, which we noted at the time was very much in opposition to what we thought was said in the Aztecs. The Hartnell era historical, one of the first historicals, there was a lot of discussion about those two different models, the Aztecs versus the Time Meddlers. So where did the randomizer take us next, Pete?
I believe it's taken us to season one, serial six, the Aztecs,
the mother freaking Aztecs. We are here. We did a human sacrifice on the steps of Pull to Open, and the sun god rewarded us with exactly the story that we needed to go to continue discussing this foundational thing in Doctor Who of, can you rewrite history? Can you change it? Is it changeable? And I got to say, Pete, I mean, so this was my first time watching the Aztecs. I came out of it with a different sense of what they were actually saying than the myth of you can't rewrite history, not one line. The Aztecs.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to look back on it and compare it with all the things they've done since in terms of rewriting time and going to historical eras and incidents, and are they really in flux or are they locked? Well, we're going to get to all that great discussion on the Aztecs. But first, everyone, we got the Pull to Open Pulse Loop coming up. However, if you would like to cut to all that commentary on the Aztecs, you can, of course, check the time code in the podcast app. Just check the notes on the podcast you're listening to. It'll be right there, very prominent. Go to this time code to go to the commentary on the Aztecs. If you're on YouTube, just scroll down a bit. It's going to be in the notes there too. But you're not going to want to do that. You won't, because you're going to miss the pulse loop. We've got an all new emoji challenge. We have results from our latest poll on what listeners thought of Full Circle. That's in Poll to Open.
Hey.
And of course, we got a YouTube comment of the week that identifies what might be the best classic Who story to introduce new Who fans to the old series. That was, of course, one of our side trips recently. Indeed. Where we picked five of the best episodes we think new Who fans can start with in the classic era. So you're gonna miss all that if you just cut right to the commentary. It's all coming up. It's all coming up.
It's like going straight to the center, of the tomb, rather than going through all of the interesting parts on the outside. Indiana Jones doesn't go just straight to the center.
No, he never does. And you know what? We're not even going to make our listeners carve a pulley out of some wood or something like that. We're just going to open up this tomb.
That's
right. This loop. And we always, of course, want to open it up by, hey, listeners, reminding you that the best way to support Pull to Open is, of course, to leave a review in the podcast app you are using right now, especially Apple Podcasts. That's a great one. Reviews, certainly those 5-star reviews especially, will help make the show visible to more listeners, especially people eager for great discussion of Doctor Who. And really, the only way to better show your appreciation for this year's podcast is to share Pull to Open with a friend. Just go ahead. Crack open. And honestly, I like the whole thing of like random friend. We're a random podcast randomly going through Doctor Who. Go ahead, fire up your contact list, randomly select someone, and then just fire the podcast over. Hey, thought you might like this. I don't know. Do you like Doctor Who? Go ahead, check it out.
If you have like a lot of friends you've watched through Who with, and you've maybe watched all of the episodes of Who with different friends, maybe just use our codex and random.org, as we do at the end of the show. Find a story randomly in your Doctor Who history. Think back to who you watched that story with. Send them the podcast. Send them on our random journey with you. And hey, I just wanted to add to that. Reviews. I know, you know, let's talk about the word reviews. When we talk about you leaving a review, you're like, whoa, hold on there, Shakespeare. You know, I don't have the time. You guys do reviews and like 2-hour long dissections of stories. I ain't got time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that. But no, you can just do a single emoji, 2 emojis, 3 emojis. If you want to do something clever and creative, you can make it a Doctor Who title, title of a Doctor Who story, and we will then use that. It's really, really a hella efficient work here, because you're reviewing us, you're giving us something for our Whomoji challenge, which is coming up. And this is the part of the program where I present myself as human sacrifice.
Nice. and the listeners appreciate it, and so do the gods. I think those might be the same thing, come to think of it. Yes.
Your gods to us.
All you listening gods out there. Yes, it is time for the Whomoji Challenge.
Oh, boy.
The contestant today is, of course, Mr. Chris Taylor.
The perfect
who
victim.
Who gets the perfect victim for this Whomoji Challenge. And it's going to be a quick one. I'm just going to check with the victim. Are you ready, sir?
Is it a heart emoji, a knife emoji, and a drop of blood emoji?
It's not. It's not even an eclipse emoji, but it's a quick one because it's one emoji.
Okay.
A single emoji.
All right.
And here it is. Human ear.
Oh, well then that... I'm feeling Capaldi because that's got to be listen.
It's listen! Nice! Yes.
The perfect victim continues his almost perfect score.
I think these are getting a little easy. I think we got to get one that's going to be like 10 emojis. Remember that time there was like 10 emojis, but most of them were cars?
Yes.
I think that would ended up being gridlock. Was that challenge? I forget. But you've basically aced the last three or four. I'm going to, like, actually, let's put the call out right now. What you were saying there about reviews and leaving emojis. Someone do that. Someone get some challenging ones out there so that we can really sacrifice Chris in one of these future emoji challenges.
That's right.
Well,
that's
done. Right. Well done, sir. That was, you know.
Thank you.
It was a good one.
I'd just like to point out, we're not in the history corner yet, but they did, the Aztecs did believe that children crying was a sacrifice to the rain gods.
Really?
I'm going to say that you guys, you listeners, making me cry with your humoji challenges is really a sacrifice to Poltawopen. And it's one of the best things you can do to get us in better sight of the sun god known as Apple. And various other gods in the canon, but thank you for
that's interesting about the crying kids. I mean, we do know the Aztecs like their cartoons, so they may have invented emojis, come to think of it.
Emojis to make you cry. So that one that we should say that came from a TikTok comment.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it came from one of our TikTok commenters with the handle Anurin. So thank you, Anurin. That was a good one. It just goes to show, like, these emoji challenges, they don't have to be particularly long. A single emoji, like, if you have a certainly one-word title, could probably do ya.
That's right.
So go for it.
That's right. It's funny, because I've been waiting for a listen for a while. So I'm like, okay, that easy answer is gone. So they're only going to be hard ones going forward.
I'm surprised it took us this long. I mean, we're a podcast. We're constantly talking about listening and listeners, particularly Spotify listeners. Hey, guys on Spotify, you know this, but in case you don't, there are even more ways to interact with the show on Spotify. You can, of course, rate the show and the episode of the show, which is to say Poltawopen, in your mobile app. But in addition to that, every week you get your voice about the story we're talking about. So in the poll feature, we ask you, the listener, what you thought of the story we were talking about. So today, this week, it's the Aztecs.
Yeah, that's right. Just go right there below our beautiful faces. Just pull that thing up there. Pull it to open, and you'll find a poll on what you think of the Aztecs.
Give it your own rating. Now, our rating system has 6 ratings. We're going to explain all those at the end of the show and maybe a little bit here. But you can pick one of those for your own. I can give a write-in rating. You go ahead, guys. Like, we've slowly expanded our rating system over time. So feel free to give your own write-in rating. But we have some results from one of our recent podcasts, and it's from Full Circle.
That's right. And these results don't close. We should say these are the results so far.
Oh, that's right.
So you can keep voting. Yep. You can vote on Full Circle if you think that this result is outrageous. So go for it.
And you might, because here it's coming right at you. Okay, so the listeners have spoken, the listening gods, and they have decided that Full Circle is a professor hater with a full half of the vote.
Wow, yes.
Like roughly 50%.
Your candidate was professor hater, so congratulations. My candidate was the Lady Cassandra, which is to say it was a paper-thin plot but looked very pretty, and was well moisturized. She only got 17% of the vote, roughly the same as the Daleks and the Ogrons, so kind of a three-way tie for second place there. So I'm going to say it, listeners, go back to the Full Circle podcast, please, and vote early and often for Lady Cassandra, because I really think that she'd make a better leader for the world of Full Circle, for the world of Azirius, than Professor Hayter. Who really just, he's not going to be happy there in his tweed jacket. It's way too warm.
Totally. Too jungle-like. But yeah, the Dalek, the rating we have for a good episode of Doctor Who, did get a showing. So some people really did like Adric's debut here and the kickoff of the East Base trilogy. But no Viscount Bangers. No one thought it was one of the best of the best, which, you know, sounds about right.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Full Circle fan clubs out there. Although I think there should be fan clubs devoted entirely to the geometric names of Doctor Who stories, which, you know, if you've not been following us recently, we went from what was it, Flatline, Arc of Infinity, Full Circle.
The line, the arc, and the circle.
That's right. And there are no Doctor Who titles with square in them, although that could have come next.
Yet.
Yes.
Is there anything coming up? There's the Giggle, the Star Beast, and Wild Blue Yonder. No geometry in any of that.
You know, I'm a TARDIS fan, so I really want to see an episode or a story titled The Round Things.
Yes.
In which we finally find what the round things are for.
Well, we've seen that. They hide the brandy.
Well, yeah, they hide various things, but like, what are they all for? Why so many, Doctor? Is it just people who have type 40s, kind of like they need lots of closet space, lots of cupboards?
Maybe lots of brandy. Maybe different spirits, you know? In more club. Ways than one.
There's a whole club behind that main TARDIS control room. It's just the chill room. All right. So we are not just on Spotify, we're also on YouTube, which is a great place to leave your emoji title in which to torture me. You can see us. You can see our Easter eggs in the background. You can see that Pete, appropriate to the Aztecs, has sacrificed a Dalek and stuck its head on a pole there. I think we have the Hartnell poster is back.
Yep.
I can see some Tardai poking out.
The original TARDIS crew. We got Susan in there somewhere.
We had our first B-roll last week, our first actual video from the location of the Time Meddler's ruined abbey. So go check that out. That's definitely a very YouTubey kind of thing. And of course, hit that bell icon for notifications for whenever we post something new. If you like me, can't wait for your Saturday morning pull to open dose. Smash that button. And I believe we have a YouTube comment from Loris Tyrrell from Game That's of Thrones. Right. Wow. It's good to hear from him again.
Handle the Smoke Gunner. So this commenter has something to say about our podcast on the best classic adventures for New Who fans, where we picked up what we thought were the top five, at least from the stories that we have done so far in the podcast. And Loris says, as someone who grew up with New Who, the Seventh Doctor's era was what got me into Classic Who. I think Ace is the most reminiscent of New Who companions, and the stories are all pretty short and the pacing is good. I'd recommend Remembrance of the Daleks for anyone wanting to get into the classic era. Great comment. I really like this. I really appreciate it because he's wrong. He's not wrong. Remembrance of the Daleks would probably have made our list had we done it for the podcast.
Yes.
Or we just haven't done it yet.
When we revise that list, as I'm sure we will do, it may make it in. I've been wanting to get to Remembrance of the Daleks, honestly, because I've been wanting McCoy to have a better showing than he's had.
Well, that's the thing. We've done so little McCoy. I think we've only done Battlefield. Am I wrong?
Yep. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. So maybe you could say the randomizer is saving the best for last. But in our podcast on Dalek, we talked about Remembrance of the Daleks being the first time you see a vaporized skeleton.
Time you see it go up the stairs.
Yes, exactly. So, it don't get enough respect, really, Remembrance of the Daleks. And it'd be good to see it again and judge whether it is indeed a good introduction. It certainly, who doesn't like Ace? Who doesn't like a teen pyromaniac rebel?
Well, that's the other great thing about this comment. It really highlights Ace, and, she was very much, he's right, again, he's exactly right. Not quite a template for New Who, but it was like, it was the late 80s and the old screaming assistant stereotype, which I think that's kind of a bit of an erroneous stereotype in the sense that I think, some of the older companions, like particularly Sarah Jane and others, went beyond it. But I mean, it was certainly always there. And then Ace completely subverts it. But in addition to that, like Sophie Aldred and the way that she was written and what they, of course, went on to do in the New Adventures and stuff, they really peeled back the layers of that type of character. And it's good that a lot of that is on screen, too. I mean, I know you haven't seen a lot of the McCoy era, but like the final season where they do stuff like the Curse of Fenric and these other adventures, Survival even, sort of you kind of get that three-dimensionality to the character. And that's why I think a lot of people think of her as one of the best companions, if not the best companion of, of the classic era.
And certainly one of the few non-posh companions in her accent. You really don't have to travel that far from Ace to Rose, do you? I mean, she really was preparing the ground for New Who. But yes, thank you for that comment, Loris. Sorry about how things went down in Westeros. But yes, you, Loris, and all of you listeners could also listen to us and watch us do our thing on TikTok, our most active social network. Pete, how many TikTok followers are we up to right now?
Oh, my goodness. It's probably 11,500,
11,500, so, yeah. Exactly the number of sacrifices that Aztecs performed per year, according to some sources in that realm. Thank you, TikTok users. Yeah, we're not going to sacrifice you if you follow us.
That wasn't just dark humor.
Yeah, no,
you've done some research.
Yeah. We are gonna get deep into human sacrifice,
okay,
folks. Yes, get ready for that. Get your obsidian blades out, and follow along with us as we rip out our own hearts. No, we would only do that on TikTok because it would make a hella viral short video.
Dude, I want to get to it, so I'm just gonna cut right to boom. You just follow. I'm going to close out the pulse loop. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook and Threads at PultaOpen63. Do that. And now let's do this. We're talking about the Aztecs.
Wow. I've never seen such self-sacrificial behavior on PultaOpen because, of course, Pete is running directly into the blade, the obsidian blade that we call TLDW.
It is my honor.
Pete, you are being the perfect victim here, and as such, I want to say before you start this, is there anything you need? Would you like to marry a Gallifreyan girl from the future? What do you want? What is it?
I would like extra time.
That is the one thing that the gods cannot grant, sir. I'm sorry. When, why would you want extra time? You know, this is your moment to join the sun god in the afterlife.
It is. Yes. It is. So let's, that's all I want. I want to join the gods. I want to have a rabbit hole free. We've been doing all right. I think we've been lulling ourselves into a false sense of security here with these TLDWs these last few weeks, but it might be short-lived because I actually didn't watch this. I watched this not very recently. So I, you know, about 5 or 6 days ago, I finished part 4. So I'm hoping I can tap into the race memory that's here in North America of the Aztecs to fully get it out.
Well, you know what, Pete? You can't rewrite history, not one line, but you can condense it, and we condense it in 30 seconds per Classic Who episodes. The Aztecs is 4 episodes, so you, sir, have a full 2 minutes to summarize this Hartnell historical. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Then, as the sky darkens and the eclipse begins, we have a full 2 minutes to reconstruct the official pull-to-open summary of the Aztecs in 2 minutes, starting now.
Okay, the TARDIS lands in an Aztec tomb, and Barbara comes out, finds the person who was a high priest. She and Susan sort of explore. They find a door out of the tomb. Susan goes to get Ian and the doctor, and Barbara is quickly discovered, but they think she's the resurrected high priest. And when Ian and Susan and the doctor come out of the tomb, they fail to realize that when the door closes, they cannot get back in. So they're cut off from the TARDIS. So, but Barbara has been accepted as the reincarnated version of the high priest, essentially a goddess, and they're going to worship her. But she tries to prevent the Aztecs from making human sacrifices because the sacrifice is about to happen and she tells them not to do it. And so the high priest of sacrifice, this guy, Tlatoxel, he basically starts, who is already suspicious of Barbara being this god, becomes openly doubtful of her. And he tries to prove that she's not really the god. Whereas, and then so her servants, which is Ian, Barbara, and Ian, Susan, and the doctor, all have to sort of try to manipulate things to get her to somehow to basically buy time for them to get back to the TARDIS and figure out a way to get into the tomb. So Ian ends up fighting this guy who's Ixta, who's like the commander of the armies, Otlok, who is the high priest there. Sort of befriends Barbara, but she can't really, get them to change history. The doctor lectures her about changing history. She still tries, but it doesn't really work. Latoxel and everyone and Ixta work against her, but eventually Ian finds another way into the tomb. He helps open it up, and right when they're going to make the sacrifice on an eclipse, they get back in the tomb because the doctor's developed a pulley system to get it open from this thing that Ian pulled out of it, and they all go back in the TARDIS and leave.
Okay. All right. A very good summary of the first episode of the Aztecs. To which you returned a lot. I was noticing that there was a lot of going back to themes established in the first episode, the rewriting one line, not rewriting one line in episode one there.
Yeah, I realized about a minute in, I had to really excise things. So I really had to make a decision. Am I going to say anything about Ian and Ixta? Am I going to say anything about Kameka?
Well,
am I going to say anything about Otlok going off into the sunset or whatever he does toward the end there?
Otlok
and
definitely
I had to throw virtually all of it out. I basically made a call to say a little bit about Ixta and then just cut to them leaving.
Yes, you had to cut out what I think is in many ways the beating red heart of the Aztecs, and the thing that most surprised me, the romance between the Doctor and his fiance.
Right.
I did not know that the Doctor had a fiance. Did he ever say this to River at any point? Did he?
Yeah, no. Centuries before River Song, centuries before Rose, he was flirting in various parts of history. And, you know, we made a comment about that last time in the Time Meddler.
Yeah.
With, I forget her name, Edith?
Edith, yes.
Who was one of the villagers who seems to be a little bit taken with the Doctor. And here it's full on. You've got Kameka just really wants him.
Yeah,
and essentially proposes to him, or kind of gets him to inadvertently propose to her
by spilling cocoa beans, which is not only used as currency but also a method of proposing someone. Which is sort of, given that they use as currency, this is a bit like, you know, you're proposing to your date in a restaurant by like just whacking out a bunch of $100 bills. And be like, hey, babe, you like the look of those? Plenty more where they came from. so, you know, it seems a little basic. But you know what? Yeah. Hey, the real surprise is, and I'm still sort of having a hard time absorbing this, the Doctor's into it. Like, she basically forces him into it. But he is so into it. And you know what? It's the Aztecs. It's season one. William Hartnell has not been ground to death by the job yet. He looks spry.
Right.
He looks young.
He does.
And healthy and handsome.
And he kind of nails that reaction, even though it's a bit overdone, when suddenly realizes what he's done. And it's like, oh, we're going to be married. And he kind of like, there's the zoom in and the audio sting and all that. It's a little too much. But it is like, you know, Hartnell does great. Like, it's a good little like, what?
He would,
moment.
But
and
also,
then,
he's like, okay.
Yeah.
Could do worse.
He kind of goes with it. Yeah, and he doesn't totally ditch her in that she's completely clueless. He kind of clues her into like, you know, this isn't going to work, but we still kind of need your help. And you know, and so they'll always have Technotillion or whatever the name of that city is.
We're going to butcher Aztec names throughout this, just FYI, if there are any Aztec historians listening. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to pronounce proper names, and I think they do a decent job in the episode itself.
They do.
I remember, so this is interesting. So taking myself back into my personal time stream, we did study the Aztecs at school, but the problem was it was in elementary school. Like, I remember it when we were first taking history, and I think this was in the early 80s, and I think they were trying pretty hard in parts of the Western world to not just do your traditional European history, essentially, right? And so we'd spend a good chunk of time, I think it was fifth grade, something like that, like on the Aztecs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I learned a lot about the human sacrifice and can say there are some accuracies here, at least to my recollection.
Yeah,
I know you've done more research for this particular podcast, but like things like the costumes that Ian and Ixta are wearing, that's very accurate. Like, as I remember learning about, like, one of the ways the Aztecs were such formidable warriors was that they would wear armor, whereas like other tribes in the Mexican heat would just be bare skinned and, you know, just kind of easy pickings. So the costumes, again, we could go on and on about the costumes.
But are amazing. And one of the best things about the Aztecs, you know, which you might know, you might have seen, as a Doctor Who fan, having looked into the show's history, you might have seen pictures of the Aztecs without having seen the Aztecs. Well, I'm here to tell you, I'm also here to tell myself of a week ago, that, wow, the script really holds up. And it really holds up in a modern context, right? So, background, of course, this is John Lucarotti, who we first encountered in Marco Polo, doing the first historical and making sure that it was not European history, right? And he's now two for two. His second historical, and again, not European history. And he'd been on vacation to Mexico. Like, he was really personally fascinated by the Aztecs, and he wrote this actually while Marco Polo was in production. But he nailed it. Like, he nailed not only, you know, a lot of the details, you know, the even like the size of the sort of the small stone on which people were sacrificed, the fact that it's like coffee table sized, 100% accurate. I think Barbara's costume has been criticized as being anachronistic. That's fine, but not really Lucarotti's problem. But what Lucarotti's script really does is amazing. It doesn't, like, the Aztecs are not like a unified single whole people, right? They are, there is debate. There's the debate of knowledge versus superstition, right? Represented by those two priests, by Ortlok and Toxel. That dude with the mouth thing and the two giant feathers coming out of his shoulders, who's playing extra evil, but sort of like, it's one of the interesting aspects of the script. Like, he's right. Barbara's a fake. And you know, from his point of view, it's perfectly right to poison her. So you've got these sort of knotty, thorny moral issues all over the place. And the Doctor loses.
Yeah.
It is the first example in Doctor Who history of, like, this show is going to surprise you. You know, everything goes wrong for everyone here, with the arguable exception of Ian, and only because he's pretty damn violent in this.
Yeah. The, you know, it's funny. You said the Doctor, we opened it up talking about how the Doctor was spry. I'd say the show itself is very spry at this point.
Yes.
I mean, this is like season one Doctor Who. It's riding high after the big win of the Daleks. It's now it's a phenomenon in Great Britain.
Yeah.
And you feel the confidence in the production here. And even though some of the, like, a lot of the studio stuff was, it was a small studio. I think that good chunks of this were shot at the Ealing Studios one of their first ones, which is like notoriously small. They made a lot of use out of whatever space they did. And I think by this point they were sort of starting to spread it around a bit. So I think parts of this might have been shot in the BBC main
Verity Lambert was agitating to get it moved to BBC Television Center. She did it for the Aztecs. Another interesting marker point with the Aztecs, you know, you mentioned the Daleks and how popular they were, but they were more sort of popular for being popular, if you know what I mean. Like, Doctor Who didn't have as good viewing figures during when the Daleks were on screen.
Right.
The first time it cracks the top 20 British TV programs is during the Aztecs.
So, oh, wow. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
It's not really riding high. It's paying off.
It's definitely not petering out. In other words, it's not like, the Daleks were great and now we're just kind of like, whatever. But people keep tuning in and again, with quality scripts like this, you can see why. You know, this is a very confident script. Like you said, we already talked about a little bit about Platoxel, but man, like, I could go on and on about that performance and that character. It's just really, like, John Ringham is the actor, and there is, the scenery looks great, but even though he chews the hell out of it throughout, and I mean, he's just amazing. It's like, what a memorable performance, and just what an inspired choice to have that makeup stripe across his face, which gives him a bit of a sort of Joker-esque feel. And just sort of
Joker-esque. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also really, in the sense that the Joker character is like often pointing out home truths, you know, that you make you uncomfortable.
And, you know, another actor might have thought, okay, the costume and the makeup's doing the work. No, he gives a very physical performance. Like, he's the way he kind of like hunches and is moving kind of like almost like a creepy jester type. Again, I keep kind of going back to that, but it's really just so many good choices about that role. And, you know, the evolution, his scenes with Barbara are very, very good. There's a lot of good dialogue between her and Plathoxel and her and Otlock. You know, those are kind of like, to me, the main, like you said, the beating heart is kind of the romance. And I think you're being obviously a little bit figurative. Like, to me, the heart of this is like, you know, Barbara's moral dilemma.
Yeah.
And her slowly kind of coming away from what I would somewhat, I know this sounds a little derisive, but it's a bit of an ivory tower perspective of a history teacher, that she kind of comes in and thinking like, oh, as this goddess, I can make a couple of decisions at the top and possibly like really improve things. And it's like good on paper, right? And one of the better conversations is later when Ian is talking to her and he's like, Barbara, you don't get it. Like, Plathoxel's not the exception, he's the rule. Yes. Like, everyone thinks that way. And so he comes from this more pragmatic standpoint, this sort of, you know, I've been around people here.
Yeah.
And this is never going to work. You know, you can't do it. And
Barbara gets a bit drunk with power. And it's such a good, I can't think of a better, there can't be any better story for Barbara. Right. And certainly in every outing we've seen for her so far, she has not reached her full potential. But here she is front and center. She is a god
and really takes command of it.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right that those scenes of her to Plathoxel with that dude, with the bad dude, with the Joker. I'm just gonna call him Joker from now on. With Orlok, like the nice guy, the guy who has all the knowledge. She's manipulating him, you know, in a very Machiavellian way. And it's extraordinary. It's definitely a case of too much, you know, a little of her knowledge, which is like what she has about Aztec history. She's, you know, a high school teacher who's done segments on it. Like, she doesn't fully know Aztec history. And here she is in the middle of it. And it's a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. She thinks she can change things, which, by the way, we'll get to whether she can or can't. You know, and what if the evil plot has succeeded? Because I think we'll both probably agree that this is the evil plot is hers.
Right.
But
the mental sort of the mental chess between her and Plathoxel is really just great to watch. I do think her decision to simply take her mask off to him, in a sense, like saying essentially like, I'm a fake.
Yeah,
but don't dare challenge me or I'll destroy you. That feels like a tactical mistake. And I don't think it's a bad choice for the script, because I think she's reacting and she's tired of the game. But I also feel like that just made him more determined than ever.
Yeah, I mean, take her down. Barbara's really blundering around in a very 20th century way. And it's kind of interesting when you consider this as a, you know, in the concept of colonial, post-colonial, right? It's actually Barbara who has the colonial attitude here, even though she's trying to be enlightened and like, let's end human sacrifice. And part of what the Doctor is saying, you know, this is why I have a slightly different take on the not one line changing history line. The Doctor is actually saying you shouldn't change this. Like, this is a deep part of their culture. In fact, human sacrifice was a deep part of all Mesoamerican culture. And we can get that in the history corner whenever you like, but but he's right. Like, you shouldn't interfere. You shouldn't come in as the colonial and think that you know best. So even though she thinks she's doing the right thing as a humanitarian, she's actually being quite blundering. So I love that she makes these mistakes in the script. I think it really works.
Before we get to the corner, I'm anxious to get to the corner here for sure. I've definitely got a little bit I might set up a little folding chair in your corner for a bit there. But all right. let's talk a little bit about the setup and some of the good choices and some of the questionable ones. So they come to the tomb, and I think they sort of believably all come out of the tomb without realizing that they can't get back in. You know, it's a nice little plot device that, you know, it's just like, well, you just can't do it. It's just designed that could only be open from the inside. So that's like, oh my God, like, what are they going to do? And you know, they're going to figure out something, but separating the TARDIS team from the TARDIS, it's obviously a necessary thing in so many adventures and goes sort of all the way to you know, the most recent ones. Like you can think about Capaldi, right? Like Oxygen is a good example where, you know, it just happens all the time. You just have to, because otherwise they have a sanctuary. Yep. And so they're in real peril. They were doing it a lot in season one, though. I will say that, like, even from the first episode.
Saw it in Marco Polo. The TARDIS itself gets stolen. We saw it in the Sensorites.
Right.
Take the key.
Lock.
Yes.
They take the lock out.
Yeah. Literally just cutting it out like they're, you know, intergalactic vandals. It's hilarious. It's an interesting, but you know what? The script kind of, it does exactly what a script should do. It's every point you're like, okay, I buy this. Okay, I buy that, you know, Barbara suddenly appearing from out of this tomb that only opens from the inside means that they would naturally think that she's got it. Like, that seems a legitimate, logical decision. It's not presented as a funny thing at all. And also, you're completely distracted from the fact that, you know, you're not seeing a lot of Aztec society here, really. But you feel like you are, which is amazing. And one thing you're not thinking of is, where's the Emperor?
Right, exactly. Like, where's Montezuma or whomever?
Yeah, Montezuma. Well, depending on various dating controversies about, there is a dating controversy you'd be glad to know about the Aztecs. If it's in the later, if it's in the, like, the 1500s, if it's in the later iterations of when the Aztecs might be set, then it would be Montezuma II, the one who, you know, presided over the downfall under Cortez. So, but you don't think about you're just like, oh, it's natural that, like, Barbara's facing off against these two priests. And one of them's the knowledge dude, and one of them's the, you know, the tradition dude. And you get it.
Yeah.
And it just feels natural. You don't think about the power structure other than that.
So one thing, just to bring it back to the tomb, I think when Ian gets in there and then comes out again, but he's got way too much confidence in that strip of material or whatever it is, that tapestry that he sort of strings under the door. I felt like that was a little like, okay, you're seriously not going to prop that up on something? Like, dude, like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I guess he sort of also might be thinking, I can just go back to the garden, and they try to, right? If they ever need to get back in again. But that's a lot of things on, you know, your complications you're giving yourself by simply not doing that thing of the simple, like, let's just prop it open with something.
Yeah.
I felt that was a kind of a blunder.
Ian's a bit lunk-headed in this, isn't he? It's interesting. Like, he's really much smarter in other, and I guess he's smart here in the way that he employs the thumb to, you know.
Let's talk about that for a second, because you're right. Ian here is a little off. It's like he's more plot device than character in various places. He's sort of put up against Ixta because, again, he's the action guy. Ixta is the general or the commander or whatever. And the first of all, let's talk about the nerve pinch or whatever it is, like the thumb.
Vulcan.
It's totally, like, obviously this happened before Star Trek, but it is like, what the hell was that? Like, you're kind of like, oh, was that ever a thing that people would have a thumb, or like like it was a nerve thing people could pinch, and that was some kind of urban legend, or I don't know. Like, it just feels so weird and out of nowhere.
You know what it feels like? It's like when you look at the stage fighting in the Aztecs, which you've got to admit is not really up to snuff. You kind of wonder if, like, the thumb thing, the nerve pinch thing, was just sort of thrown into stage fighting to kind of be like, you know, okay, if you get exhausted from these not very convincing moves that you're doing. Just end the fight with a nerve pinch thing and you'll believe. Like, it feels like it predates Doctor Who, must predate Star Trek as a thing you would just do if a stage fight needed to be brought to an end quickly without the actors looking like they needed a knockout blow, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like one of these things that I think people just thought, I don't know if they really love this, like about fighting where there were weak spots on the human body, which there are. I mean, I no question, but it's like, it's the kind of thing where it's usually much more serious than like simply knocking the person. Like if you would say like karate chop someone in the throat, for example, like that's kind of like, oh yeah, you'd probably kill them like right away if with enough force, but that's not a thing you just want to casually throw out there. Like I can do unless, you know, it's you're literally want to kill a guy. So I think there might've been like some thought about that, but it's like, it's, you know, why would he never use that again? Certainly later when they're actually fighting, like even within this story, like I don't, it's just a weird random thing they threw in, to sort of give Ian a little bit of one-upness. Now, just now that, forgetting the nerve pinch for a second, like how is Ian, a science teacher, somehow going toe-to-toe with Ixta and doing pretty well before he's drugged? Who this guy is a lifelong warrior, and like how is that even possible? Like that is, did I miss some line where like Ian was the captain of his university wrestling team or something? I mean,
they really should have thrown in something like that, because in the absence of that, I'd say that this is the only part of the Aztecs that feels very sort of colonial. Like, oh, well, of course, the young, smart, upstanding, clean-cut British man would be able to disarm this savage by merely applying some pressure to the neck. You know, it's got that sort of arrogance to it. And, you know, it's not great. And which is sort of a shame, because the rest of the narratives is like, it feels so progressive. And that actually wants, I want to talk about the whole TARDIS team before we move into the Easter corner. We should mention Susan.
Yeah.
Carol Ann Ford was basically on vacation for half of the Aztecs. And you know what? The Aztecs does not suffer because of it. She's she's packed off to a seminary to learn Aztec lore. And these are scenes that they sort of inserted into those episodes so she could go off on vacation. And John Luke Rorty basically just recycles a little bit of Marco Polo. You know, last time Susan was with a young woman who was betrothed to another man against her will. This time it's, you know, it's Susan herself, you know, that's the peril that she's in. And it kind of works, and it gives her a good speech. Like that sort of Susan's best moment is like, no, I want to marry who I want to marry. Damn it. You know, I get the choice. I'm a human being. So, you know,
it's funny. Every time we go to a Hartnell episode, I feel like someone's sick or on vacation. For like,
really,
I think if you actually inventoried the Hartnell episodes, it's probably like half of them have notable absences or, you know, cutscenes like these. It's funny just how they made it back then. You know, they're doing it every single week, and you know the time between when the actors even got the script and when they were actually producing it, and the time it was broadcast was really, really, really short.
Yeah,
to the point where they were even still fixing certain episodes when the previous one was airing.
It's so funny, and I guess it's a legacy of the fact they didn't think of them as discrete stories, right? They were just episode by episode. It was an episode of the week thing. Like there was no such thing as the Aztecs. There was just differently named episodes. But if you were doing it today, and if you were thinking as the Aztecs, then you might, you know, for example, you might just drop off a companion, you know, on a different planet before they go there, right? Invent some reason. Oh, they're stuck in the TARDIS. Oh, they, you know.
Yeah,
you
see that's like in Kinda, where Nyssa is just having a nap throughout the episode.
Exactly.
It's like, okay, we're just going to do Tegan and Adric. Those are the only companions we need in this one.
Yep, that works. That was old school. All right, so yeah, that's Ian, Barbara, and Susan. So is it time to enter the corner?
Let us enter the Pull to Open History Corner with Chris Taylor.
So I was, as a certified historian, don't try this at home. Actually, do try this at home, but just be careful about your sources. I was concerned about the image presented in the Aztecs because, you know, not knowing much about the Aztecs beyond the fact that they were annihilated by Cortez, and the conquistadors, one of the earliest and most horrific examples of European colonization of the Americas. I was suspicious because I'm like, well, how do we know that the Aztecs were into human sacrifice? But maybe this was just the Spanish justifying their conquest after the fact. Well, as it turns out, not only do we have we discovered in 2015, researchers in Mexico City excavated a tower, a new section of a tower that we know existed in the Aztec capital that was underneath Mexico City, Tower of Skulls. We now have more than 600 surviving examples of Aztec skulls. And we also have children's skulls. We have examples of child sacrifice. One interesting thing that we see in the bodies of these children that were recovered is that they were in pain, man. They were in pain anyway. Mm. They had abscesses in their teeth. They had, broken bones and things. They were kind of basically made to cry. They were not happy children, by accident or design. And that was, part of why they were sacrificed to the rain god and made to cry as much as possible during the ceremony. So Lucarotti was really sanitizing a lot of these Aztec cemeteries. So, it's a little bit close to the bone that they get as close to the bone, if you will, in the Aztecs and Doctor Who. It was brutal. But you've got
actually a short documentary. I watched this on the DVD and there's a short documentary. It looks like it was made for something else entirely. And that just is sort of like the Cliff's Notes version of the Aztecs and Cortez. But they describe Cortez being sort of taken to Montezuma's temple or asking to go in and see, what it's like and with some plans to convert them to Christianity. And then just being utterly horrified by just how much blood and it's just all the walls are stained red in sort of the main chamber or whatever because of just the constant, sacrifices one after the other.
And he and his conquistadors also did experience human cannibalism, which was part, a smaller part, but still a part of the culture at the time. We've been lots of historical debates about why was this the case, but there is no doubt that the Aztecs performed thousands of human sacrifices, and it was probably exaggerated, not just by the Spanish, but also by the Aztecs themselves as a way of holding their enemies at bay. Because, if you dug into it, Cortez would not have succeeded without allies. He had native allies who also hated the Aztecs and wanted to get rid of them. So he had a ready-made mercenary army.
The Aztecs themselves were conquerors. They were formidable warriors, and they ousted everyone else in their immediate sphere of influence or subjugated them. So,
and they're roughly contemporaneous with the Tudors, which is interesting. Roughly for about the same time as the Tudors were on the throne of England, the Aztecs were present in Mesoamerica. I mean, they're much more new and up to date than you might think.
Unless you think this is all just extraneous historical detail, it's all going to come around when we talk about what if the evil plot had succeeded, by the way, everyone. So stay tuned for that.
So human sacrifice. Look, basically, they had a different perspective. And their perspective was that we all carry little bits of the sun around inside us, and it's called the heart. And it was very much part of their culture and part of their religion and part of their cultural history that you did occasionally perform ritual human sacrifices, as other cultures have done in the past, as we know from the Bible.
Certainly
culture, Judeo-Christian culture, is not immune to human sacrifice. It's just a thing, and you do it to keep the universe in balance. You do it not just to appease the gods, but just because that's how things were done. And the Aztecs had these legends, which, I'm going to say the word penis and pull to open for the first time, and hopefully the last, because that is Quetzalcoatl, the god that Cortez was thought to be, literally brought humanity forth or gave life to human beings via a wound in his penis. By the blood from his penis. So,
okay,
there was so much blood, so much
blood. I was fine with the penis, blood. The word. Yes. Now no, I'm a little like, not okay with it. But anyway, go
well,
on.
You know, if you're not okay, though, you'll really not be okay with an excellent novel by Orson Scott Card, who is an asshole for other reasons, but he wrote an excellent novel called The Redemption of Christopher Columbus, in which these time travelers are trying to get the Aztecs to increase their civilization so that they can go and invade Europe instead of the other way around. And one of the time travelers has to appear to the Aztecs with metal studs in his penis. And then he withdraws each one of them, blesses them with the blood. And I was at the time reading that, I was like, hang on a minute, Orson Scott Card, what are you talking about? But no, it's absolutely real. Like, they were all about blood and wounds and the cleansing power of blood. And when you're tearing the heart out of a human being, as they did with the obsidian blades, we know exactly how they did it. They came up through the abdomen, cut up through the chest cavity,
wow,
ripped out the heart. And it was like, you bring that bit of the heart back to the sun, you set it on fire, and the smoke goes up to the sun.
Now that's reminding me of Temple of Doom, although Mullah Ram's method was a little different from what you were talking about, but yes.
I honestly don't remember that, but yes. Yeah,
you don't remember Mullah Ram and Temple of Doom reaching into the guy's chest, pulling out the heart, and it exploding into flames?
It's been since about 1985 since I saw the Temple of Doom, and they may have ignored that bit probably for good reason. But yeah, so it was a thing, and it was so inherent to Aztec culture that the Aztec priests continued to do it even after the Spanish conquest. And you have lots of these, Spanish friars going over and saying, "Hey, maybe chill it with the killing people." You know, a little hypocritical of the Spanish to say that, but nonetheless,
right.
And they were like, no, this is us. This is part of our culture. Look, it's on cartoons, on our temples, you know. We just do this. It's what we believe.
Yeah. Getting sort of vibes of the lottery, the short story. Yes. You know what I mean? Like in terms of what, well, and also like what Barbro is trying to do and sort of recognizing how incorrect just generally this is, and that it is something that is correctable. Again, on paper, easily, in practice, nearly impossible. And, Tlatoxtl there representing that, the tradition, the need for that to go forward, because it would otherwise threaten his entire worldview and way of life.
Yeah, I almost wanted him to do the song Tradition from Fiddler on the Roof. That would have been an excellent explanation of his character and a way to make him sort of sympathetic. But yeah, so, you know, it's really accurate. I love that Lucarotti put in the script the bit where the victim, you know, Barbro basically saves the first victim. And the victim's like, right. No, screw
Did
you.
Did not like that.
No, I'm supposed to die. This is supposed to be a glorious death. By the way, most of the sacrifices were people that they captured from opposing cities in this weird thing called the Flower War, which is basically ritual combat in which they agreed to just sort of go to war, but like don't kill anyone, just take each other as prisoners, and then you can go off and like sacrifice some of them.
I'm just gonna pull out yet another reference that sounds like, you know, this is like Taste of Armageddon type Star Trek vibes there, where it's like, yeah, we don't. The war isn't the point. It's more like the suffering.
Yep, the suffering and the ritual sacrifice is the point, and it sort of enhances the power of the state, and it, you know, it ritualizes the gods, and you feel that everything is in order and everything is in balance. But you also, you know, as they point out in the Aztecs, you like, if you're that victim, you are venerated. You are the perfect victim. You get whatever you want, and it's quite an honor. And by the way, if you refused to be a sacrificial victim, they did exactly the same thing to you, only they were being mean to you while they did it, instead of venerating you. They like shouted insults at you as they cut your chest cavity open. So you might as well go with the flow. Might as well get the veneration. You're going to die anyway.
Yeah, talk about societal pressure. Damn.
Right? Exactly. Whoa, peer pressure. Not only are we going to cut your heart out with the blade of obsidian, which is sharper than anything on Earth, you know, that occurs naturally, we're also going to taunt you.
Man, 15th century cancel culture was brutal.
Absolutely. Yeah. All
right.
Tell the meanest jokes and post memes about you.
Well, that was a robust history corner. I don't know. Yeah. Should we talk about the changing history corner a little bit?
Yeah. So changing history. Yeah. I really think that that was what the Doctor was saying. Because, of course, they're interfering in history all the time. Like, you know, Kamika didn't have a fiance before the Doctor came along. unless you believe like there was someone else she met in that garden at that time and she persuaded him to spill cocoa beans. And like, no, I don't believe in that sort of fatalistic nonsense. No, they're going around changing history. What the Doctor is saying, it is inadvisable to change even a single line of history.
Exactly. So
this matches up with the Time Meddler.
Yeah, exactly. There's less here about the science of not changing history, if you will. Mm. I mean, you know, science in quotes. Then you might remember, and sort of it. In other words, I think a lot of people might have backread into the Aztecs, including me, a bit more about like, oh, this is history simply can't be changed, and there's we know this didn't happen because of X or Y, and sort of giving the impression that time is immutable once it's sort of in place. And but no, you're right. You're dead on. It's clear that what Hartnell's, if that were the case, Hartnell wouldn't be imploring Barbara not to do it because she wouldn't be able to do it anyway.
Exactly.
So clearly she can, like she physically can, she can physically change history if she really tries. It's just really, really inadvisable. Like, just don't do it.
And they do have that sort of scene at the end where the Doctor tries to comfort her when she realizes that basically he was right. And he's like, oh, it's okay. And he has the sort of the most bland comfort, which is like, oh, well, you kind of helped one man, by which I think he means Ortlok, right?
Yeah.
Ortlok, the priest of knowledge, who's basically just been driven into self-exile because he can't stand this nonsense that's going on around him. How did she help him? How is that helping? Yeah,
it's too bad he doesn't really have a memorable moment. He does help them by essentially giving his possessions to, I think, Kamika to bribe someone to make sure they could rescue Susan. I think that's sort of what happens. And that's good, but it's not very visceral, right? He just kind of like hands this thing over and leaves.
Yeah.
You kind of want a better moment with Ortlok. It's kind of too bad that he never quite, you know, like you don't see him go off in the sunset. You don't sort of feel good about what's happened to him. You just sort of get a little bit of comfort from the Doctor to Barbara. But again, it's pretty cold comfort at that point. Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah,
it is a shame, but it sort of rewards repeat watching, I think the Aztecs does. Like, you know, you go back and you see the subtlety of moments like that, the way that Ortlok, Keith Pyott, really a very good Ortlok, and he kind of just brings this sort of brokenness to that scene, I think, of like, oh, yeah, I can't, like, I've been, and it's really Barbara's manipulation that's done it. So, like, she's really done worse. You know, the Doctor's comfort is no comfort at all. And I think that's sort of the Lucarotti's intention here. Really, really subtly good script in a lot of ways like that.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of like, if Ortlok doesn't have some massive influential change in history, again, I think you can get philosophical with it and tend to agree with the Doctor and the fact that Ortlok, if he's changed... I might be overreading here, but it's a little bit echoey of the final lines in The Doctor Falls, where Capaldi is talking about, I'm doing this because it's right. And yes, everyone's kind of going to die anyway, but this is the right thing to do. And if that has happened to Ortlok on some level, even if he doesn't, you know, again, like maybe you might be feel like, oh, he should be able to like write his memoirs or something. Maybe that has some influence on this, right? No, like he's just a changed man and that's enough, you know? And again, it's it's a bit of maybe a bit of an overread in terms of the philosophy, but I think that's kind of what they're getting at here, and like that can still be a triumph, in even though it's just a minor sort of epiphany on one person.
Well, Big Finish, if you're listening, we'd love to have the further adventures of Ortluck, in which he just sort of goes out into the wilderness and kind of has a nice time. He's like, hey, this is a pretty cool cabin I've just built out here in the woods. Kind of glad that I left the city. That human sacrifice was getting a bit weird. And then that's it. He just kind of chills out. Three episodes of him fishing.
You know, and maybe he fishes up Adric's botany or something, because it's like, didn't the ship crash there around Mexico? Like, yes. I don't know.
He's like, oh, yeah. Yes, the high priest's knowledge. And then he's possessed by the spirit of Adric. Okay. Love
there
this.
There it is. Matthew, there's your big finish.
Call your agent. Love it. Ortluck and Adric, the team up you never thought you wanted.
So, you mentioned the moment where they're sort of back in the tomb and he's comforting Barbara. And then there's that little, almost not quite a coda, but the sort of final bit where he seems to leave the pulley for a second and then comes back and gets it. Because I think it's sort of like not huge or anything, but it is that sort of final little punctuation mark, that final little bit of frosting on the plot of changing history versus not changing history and like being responsible about it.
It's not epic, but good. It's a nice touch of like the Doctor deciding he shouldn't leave a wheel for the Aztecs because they didn't invent one. Now,
or archaeologists rather, like, you know, would probably more confuse future people. Like, wait a minute.
That's right. Yeah, you got to think that the Doctor, as he got older and into more incarnations, was a lot more slapdash about leaving stuff all over the place.
especially his TARDIS.
Yeah, my goodness. Yeah, he really stopped just cleaning up after himself after a while. Just got the companions to do it. I don't know. I feel like there's been Doctor ephemeris scattered throughout history. One more thought on the changing time thing. Like, this is, it's really interesting, isn't it, that the only... We sort of think of the Aztecs as introducing the concept of the fixed point in time, as it were. But that's really more of a New Who thing, right?
Yeah, it is.
When do we hear about it? Is it Fires of Pompeii? Is it before that?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think it's Fires of Pompeii. It might be before that. If there is, listeners, let us know what
and
it is.
It is interesting. Of course, Fires of Pompeii ends with that message of just save one family, right? The Capaldi family.
Right, save someone.
Yeah. So it does harken back to the Aztecs in interesting ways, but it is New Who that says you can't rewrite this particular history, not one line. It's not old.
Right. And that fighting time itself, which, you know, echoes all the way back to the Waters of Mars, which we've done for the podcast. So that's a good sort of randomizer connection. In fact, why don't we go right to that randomizer connection by answering that very question, which is, of course, is the first question of the four questions to Doomsday.
Four questions to Doomsday were, of course, asked by all Aztec priests of their charges in seminaries. No, that was about the five sons. Anyway.
Yes. God of the randomizer. What era was that? But that's what we have to talk about, which is, of course, the first question. Why did the randomizer take us here?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, moot. We've dealt with it. It's got, God, we really, it took us from the time metal to the Aztecs. It took us exactly where we needed to go, exactly where we were talking about going. It took us from old Hartnell to young Hartnell. And it's quite heartbreaking seeing his sort of degeneration, as it were.
Well, I thought he was still between the two. Spry enough in the Time Meddler with his comedic moments.
He's pretty spry, but towards the end of Hartnell, you're kind of like willing him to say the line. Like, go on with it. You can get through this line. You can remember this line. I know you can. You've got it in you. And he just, you know, he's got a bit more flop sweat in front of the TV cameras. And you just sort of by the end of Hartnell, it kind of tips over. You start to feel sad.
Oh, certainly. Like, we've done the Smugglers and the 10th Planet for the podcast. Yeah. So we've definitely seen sort of end of Era Hartnell, and you're dead on. He's very tired. And
but here you can see his doctor in full force. Mm. So it's nice that the randomizers sort of leave. If we're leaving the Hartnell era, which we don't even know yet, but sort of leave us on a nicer note of like, you know, young lead actor William Hartnell, who is believable as a sort of romantic lead with Kamika, has that joie de vivre.
I mean, when we're talking about the Time Meddler, we even talked about the TARDIS team and talking about Steven and Vicky vis-a-vis the original team. And here we are. This is like, boom, let's see the original.
Compare I love seeing this.
Definitely one of my favorite TARDIS teams, by the way. Like the original, it's hard. It's really hard to beat this cast.
Yeah, possibly with the exception of Susan, who was just, you know, always kind of given short shrift. And, you know, I think we sort of talked about this a lot with the Sensorites, that, you know, that chronologically the next story after this, where she just doesn't come out of that looking very good.
Yeah, I think here she's a little muted, clearly, because she's separated from them. But when she can interact with the cast, like in the first episode and the last episode, particularly the first episode when she's just in the tomb with Barbara a little bit, like she brings that energy, right? She's obviously the young teenager, curious, super duper curious, and when they can lean into that and they're not trying to do something like with her like rebelliousness in the Sensorites, or she's just kind of off somewhere like here, I think it really works. And I think in what we've done so far, I think Marco Polo and Edge of Destruction, sorry, not Edge of Destruction, what's the other one? Planet of Giants, that's the other one. Tend to show her in a better light. The last thing I would say about the randomizer connection was what I was going earlier about just sort of the Waters of Mars coming, like, you know, essentially like this is the first taste of explicitly talking about changing history. And then the Waters of Mars, which of course we've also done for the podcast, is really the culmination of that whole fixed point in time point of view on time travel. And Waters of Mars is great. I give it, I think it's a banger. It's an amazing episode. But it does get a little weird with the time changing and how that's supposed to go and what the time responsibility is.
Yeah. With regard to it. Yeah. New Who did get a little weird there. It's interesting. But yeah, on that note, I think there's also a connection you can draw to two stories ago to the time, Full Circle. Where basically what the TARDIS team, what the Doctor learns is you shouldn't interfere with this evolution that's going on in this planet.
Right.
It just, like, you're trying to hold back the swamp creatures. Well, you shouldn't, because they become the crew. Like, it just let history take its course. Which is exactly the lesson that we get from the Aztecs.
Well, so many lessons here in the Aztecs, and certainly some for Barbara. And we're going to get right on that in the second question, which is, what if the evil plot had succeeded?
Yeah, well, so of course, everyone we see as evil in the story does succeed. The practice of human sacrifice continues. Dude, it looks like the Joker.
Platoxel's on top.
Wow, now there's a big finish title to
come to on top.
it's the Charles in Charge of the big finish range. So you've got to say that the evil plot is Barbara's, because she doesn't know what she's doing and she's trying to rewrite history. And if it has it, so her thing is, you know, again, this sort of very kind of paternalistic colonial kind of concept of like, well, if you savages just clean yourselves up and stop sacrificing humans, then when Cortez gets here, he'll recognize you as proper, you know, proper people, and he won't wipe you out. And no,
definitely a bad look. But again, I have to say it again, I don't think she's wrong in that this is the thing. Let's think about if Shad actually works, right? This is, if her evil plot succeeds, somehow she sort of figures out politically how to either deal with Platoxel. By the way, it's like when he tries to poison her, why doesn't she just destroy him right then? It feels like that's a big crime, regardless of whether she's a god or not. So say maybe that occurs to her. This is sort of how it could happen. Mm. Platoxel's executed. She then uses whatever knowledge and advice from Ian and whoever to run a more of a grassroots campaign against human sacrifice. It takes a while, but it works. And then maybe she leaves, maybe she doesn't, but the Spaniards show up and now they're the human sacrifice is gone. You know, in other words, like it's basically like, oh, so now they presumably, again, this is sort of presumption on presumption on presumption, but say they don't destroy the Aztecs and instead form some kind of alliance.
Right.
And because of what we talked about in terms of the influence and just military might of the Aztec Empire, like, does that then become the foundation of Western civilization? Are they more formidable than even other colonial powers that come to North America? Would that be possible that Western society becomes more of like this Spanish Aztec alliance as a
quite
foundation?
Quite possible. And certainly an alliance is not out of the question. You know, of course the Aztecs did venerate Cortez, thought that he was Quetzalcoatl, a snake god, appropriately enough, since he did turn out to be a snake. But yeah, you know, of course, and the Spanish wanted gold, and the Aztecs could supply them with gold because they didn't care about gold. One of my favorite parts of this research was learning that the Aztecs literally called gold sun shit. you know, it was like just nasty stuff to them. They weren't into it.
Just a worthless metal.
Exactly. So if they just realized that they could make a lot of money out of the Spanish by selling this worthless, literally shit, you know, they that could have formed a very, very profitable alliance. However, I'm going to say that that's probably not going to happen because Cortez was already allied with the other native tribes before he got there. And they had been fighting for, according to some accounts, centuries with the Aztecs. Like, they hated these guys. And so it's almost like Cortez was being manipulated by his mercenaries who way outnumbered him.
Interesting. To take, I wonder if that's kind of, is that like a controversial take? Was Cortez the puppet?
Yes.
Of these other tribes.
In a sense, yes. I mean, of course, you know, the Spanish end up on top kind of almost accidentally, in part because they bring over all their interesting European diseases. So, yeah, you know, Barbara, you're really not going to change history here. First of all, you're not going to extract human sacrifice from Aztec culture, from Mesoamerican culture. You're not going to do it. The Spanish couldn't do it by force. You're not going to do it by being nice, you know, relying on your librarian dude. Just not going to happen. I feel like history here, you know, unless you do what I was talking about in that great science fiction book, The Redemption of Christopher Columbus, unless you are like committed to the bit and you're like, I'm a god, here's what you got to do. You got to invade Europe. Right.
That's committed to the bit. Wow.
Yes. By 1492, I want you on ships going to Spain. You know?
Wow.
You could.
Well, actually, it's funny. Okay. So we actually forgot, or let's talk about it now. We didn't talk about the dating controversy.
Yes.
And in terms of when is this story exactly supposed to be? Because if they do, that's a really intriguing possibility. I love alternate history. So the whole idea of either like a Spanish Aztec alliance or some kind of barber-driven, inadvertently, invasion of Europe by the Aztecs, those would be great. Like, I'd love to see sort of parallel Earth where this happens. But it's a big question on when it happens. So Barbara says that Yataxa, that the stuff on the priest in the tomb is from the early Aztec period. And she estimates, I think something like 1430 or something like that was roughly when that person would have lived. So then a lot of people thought, okay, maybe it's 1430 or a little bit after 1450 or something. But there's other issues with that. And I think it's basically, it has to be before the Spaniards come.
Right.
But there's basically a school of thought that suggests maybe it's actually in the early 1500s, right?
Which would be post-Columbus, but pre the arrival of any of the conquistadors.
Yeah, so I think the A-History guides pin it at about 1507.
Right.
And I don't know, like, does it matter? I feel like...
Well, it does. Kind of, if it is 1507, then you do have to ask yourself the question, where the hell is Montezuma? Like, is he just... Mm. Being really struck down with Montezuma's revenge himself. Like, he's just, that's why he's off screen. He's been eating too many avocados and tomatoes. By the way, do you want to give a shout out to the Aztecs for avocados and tomatoes, which form about 50% of my diet. So thank you very much.
Nice.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's the dating controversy. You know, it's, I love, all aspects of this, but one aspect of the possible alternate history of what if the evil plot succeeded here is, like, if Barbara does decide, like, the only way she can do this is invade Europe first, like, she gets really maniacally into it. I love the idea that the TARDIS team is going to, like, peace out, leave Barbara there, like, do what you will. Like, she becomes the first TARDIS companion ejected because she, you know, she got too maniacal.
She got too into it. She got too close to the flame.
That's right. It's what happens when you take a history teacher back in time.
So the dating controversy may factor in our third question, which of course is, where is the Clara Splinter?
Hey,
Clara Oswald, of course, splintered in time. At the end of the name of the Doctor, she is somewhere in every single Doctor Who story. Where is she in the Aztecs?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Did you notice the moment in the Aztecs that was taken and used for the name of the Doctor? Where
I didn't.
The Doctor sort of it's in there. Like, I think episode 2, maybe thereabouts. You know the bit where he's about to enter his time 40 TARDIS, and in the beginning of the name of the Doctor. And Clara says, like, no, don't take that one. Take this one. It's busted. But that moment where he turns around, he's like, yes, what is it? That is taken from, like, his actual character was pulled out of the background of a scene in the Aztecs. So that is literally the William Hartnell that we're seeing there in that Clara scene. But where is she in Mexico itself? I'm going to say that, because all of this, like, as I mentioned, the Aztecs really sanitized how bad the human sacrifice was, and, like, the rivers of blood coming off the pyramids and the beating heart and all of this stuff. I'm going to say that Clara actually shows up a few years earlier, does the whole Barbara thing herself, which is kind of why they're all so ready for it.
Just
gets them to chill out a little bit on the human sacrifice. Like, just don't make it so bloody.
Like, just or at least have a big army of, like, people with cleansers and, like, mops and stuff.
Exactly.
Just after you do it, like, guys, go ahead and sacrifice, but come on, like, get a cleaning crew here.
Yeah, I'm going to introduce you to the concept of sanitation. It's, you know, this is going to be great work. You know, the Aztecs were great communitarian workers. Like, they basically had a communist system. So, like, you know, it could get workers from anywhere for any reason. There were also a lot of slaves from, you know, the Wars of the Flowers. You could absolutely do that. So maybe she's, like, saying, hey, let's cool it on the crying children as well, by the way. Let's call it on the child sacrifice, because she would have to do all this to prevent the Doctor's hearts from being turned here, from the Doctor sort of going in the Barbara direction of, like, oh crap, there are crying children now. Like, we literally know
the
Doctor cannot resist a crying child. You know, we know that from the Beast Below. So
that's his kryptonite.
Yeah. So I'm calling it. Clara did the Barbara act. She was a resurrected priestess years earlier. Comes out of the tomb, gets them to just tone it down just in time for the Doctor's visit. Either that, or she's keeping Montezuma distracted from this entire story.
Oh, there you go. They're vacationing somewhere.
Yes.
So speaking of people taking breaks, basically Montezuma took a break from history. I like that. That could work. The other thing I thought of was with the dating controversy. So with it being whether 1450 or 1507 or whatever. By the way, one of the things that doesn't align properly with the 1430-50 date is the the eclipse. The eclipse, there's apparently an eclipse in Mexico towards the end of the 15th century, I think. So maybe that's another reason why it should be there. So if we want to set this in either the early 16th or late 15th, I think what Clara needs to be is a contemporary of Yataxa and essentially be her, it's a him, I guess, his fashion advisor. And that's like, no. You've got to wear stuff from the early period only.
Yeah.
And because all this new stuff is just lame and it's not befitting of a person of your status. So that when he's buried, presumably in, you know, 1490 or something, that he just has all this old stuff. So Barbara can't place the date. Yes. So that's how that works.
And Clara can also put Yataxa on a diet, like just to make sure that his bangle will fit Barbara when she comes along, right?
Because there you
that's
go.
The main reason why she's identified as the resurrection. It's this particular, it's a snake bangle, right? It's some sort of snake that wraps around her arm.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah,
a little precursor for the Mara there, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's putting Yataxa on a avocado only diet, just to make sure that Barbara will fit into his jewelry many years hence.
Works. It works. Mm. All right, all. We've come to it. We've come to the final question, the ultimate question, the only question that matters for the Aztecs. What did we think of this story? The Pull to Open rating system, of course, has 6 ratings. There's the Dalek, which we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. The Ogron, which we give to a not-so-good episode of Doctor Who. And Professor Hayter, which we give to a not-so-great episode, but hey, at least we learned something. Maybe they tried something. Hmm. The Viscount Banger, which is what we reserve for the best of the best. The Fixed Point in Time, which is, we're only on the 5th one, by the way, guys. the Fixed Point in Time, which is a story that we can't rate. Usually for reasons of nostalgia, but sometimes for other reasons, it is something that exists outside our rating system. And finally, the Lady Cassandra, the Doctor Who story that is better thought of as wallpaper. Just turn down the volume, put it in the background, and sure, it looks pretty, but you probably don't want to actually watch it.
Yes, just moisturize it. Don't watch it. Well, you know what? It's pretty clear that we both like this. And I think the only question is it a Dalek or is it a Viscount Banger?
That is the only question.
You're in that same realm.
I'm in the pull to open Schrodinger's box here of. Which is it? I'm almost reluctant to open it because although I'm tempted to give it a Viscount Banger, I think this is just a really good Dalek. I'd even give it like an Emperor Dalek status. It's a really, really good episode of Doctor Who. I can't say I was completely blown away by it or if it's really, really epic or has a certain layer to it that is just oh so awesome. No, this is just really, really good Doctor Who. And, I'm giving it essentially an Emperor Dalek, and it's structurally, I think it's a little different from what we even tend to expect from this era, because as you said, like the bad guys essentially win, don't even get any kind of comeuppance. There's a little bit of like clearly Shakespearean structuring going here with, you know, a lot of stuff happening in throne rooms and, Machiavellian stuff going on in the background. Again, Doctor Who does that occasionally, but this is very, very kind of like a Shakespearean history lesson. But I really give it points. I mean, they were really going for it here at this point in season one, and it really pays off. This is a great, great episode, well remembered. But there's also probably a reason why you don't think to go back to it all that often. Yeah. It comes very close to being epic, but isn't quite there.
All right, so Emperor Dalek, that's your final question.
Yep.
Emperor Montezuma Dalek.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the Montezuma Dalek. It's got a really good design. The little balls and stuff have like patterns on them and stuff. It's so crazy.
Now, I'm just figuring out, I'm just now imagining Dalek sacrifice where you just strap a Dalek down to a table and like you just extract the mutant inside it. pull it out and wow.
Whoa.
Okay.
Can you find the Dalek mass grave?
Yeah. My goodness. That is I was gonna say that's Big Finish, but no, that's an RTD call us. That's an episode right there. Dalek Boom. Version of human sacrifice. Yeah, we're just throwing out these ideas for free. You're welcome, Doctor Who. I'm gonna say banger.
Declare
it a Viscount banger, and here's my reasoning.
Okay.
I was thinking throughout it, and especially in the fight scenes, I was like, well, no, I can't rate, like, it's a really good script, but I can't rate it a banger because fight scenes, right? Because they're just like crap 60s fight scenes.
Yeah.
Ian's not very good, and the nerve pinch and all of that. Here's why I can overlook that and give this banger status. I finished The Aztecs last night, and it has just been in my head. It got in my head by ending it with, you know, the bad guys who maybe weren't even really the bad guys in the first place won, and the good guys who weren't really even the good guys lost. And it's so mature and so thorny in its plot. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, it may be one of the most mature plots Doctor Who has ever done, I think. And I'm amazed that Lucarotti wrote it all on a boat. That's pretty cool. We talked about recently a show in the 70s where he didn't write it because he was stuck on his boat and there was a postal strike the nearest town. Big fan of what Lucarotti did here. Like, I this is so good, it almost makes me want to go back to Marco Polo. Right,
because
gave that a fixed point of time, but now I'm like, no, Lucarotti can write. Like, maybe I need to take another look at that. So, yeah, for the fact that it will just sit in your brain and explode little bombs of thought throughout the day after you watch it, I'm going to give it a Viscount banger.
I think, yeah, I get you. It's definitely aged well. I think there's a certain amount of layering that we're sort of putting on it, mm-hmm. that probably didn't quite occur to them. Like, in other words, with the canon of Doctor Who now very robust and spanning nearly 60 years, it's such a interesting thing to that sort of goes against a lot of what we might expect of Doctor Who. But I think that's sort of something we throw on in hindsight, and with, as sort of Doctor Who nerds, wanting sort of that depth to be there. I don't know if it's really there to begin with. So while I see what you're saying, I'm also like, I'm almost convinced to make it a banger, but I'm still sticking with my Emperor Dalek. Since we've been doing this lately, I've got the rankings from Doctor Who magazine.
Yeah.
And this has been, the Essex has been remarkably consistent in that it has stayed at like number four, number five in almost every poll since 1998. And it's still at number four. So it's very high on the list. So it is very well revered, well remembered story, and 100% on the Lucarotti can write, because boy can he.
Right. We mentioned last week the Time Meddler is number two in that list. Is that correct?
Time Meddler is now number two. It has risen.
Yeah.
In every time, and was formerly number five, just behind the Aztecs, and now it has overtaken it.
Yeah, I've got to say, now I've seen them both, I think that is a monstrous miscarriage of justice. I think there's no question that the Aztecs is the better story. And the Time Meddler is good, but it's pretty basic. And, you know, it's got kind of crap Vikings in it. Like, you know, it doesn't have, it doesn't really respect the history of its own era the way that the Aztecs does.
Honestly, for the costumes alone, it's better than the Time Meddler. I'll just punctuate saying what my kids thought of it. They really like the Aztecs. Like, it really got them. They really look forward to like seeing each night. We watched it actually over four nights. So that was kind of fun too. We like,
that's definitely
one episode per night. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a bit of a slow roll, like they were into the first episode, but they were drawn more into it, which each subsequent episode, to the point where they were really looking forward to finishing the story. And they all really liked it. They liked the fighting. There was an interesting note that even the backdrops, so the matte painting sort of stuff that they did for the backdrops, which to us, I think, is pretty obvious when, as Doctor Who fans and seeing that stuff, they couldn't quite tell. They didn't really see it until they watched the documentary sort of bit on the DVD. And so, like, you know, they were so into the story that was being told that they were fooling themselves into thinking that it probably looked better than it really did, which I think is a really good testament to, again, a great episode of Doctor Who.
Absolutely. It does feel very theatrical, as a lot of TV drama did. But when you think about the fact that, like, they had basically one take, right?
Yeah.
To do all of these scenes, and they nail it, and there's some really good close-ups, and, you know, it just really does engage you, and you aren't drawn to think about the backdrops, you know, being a bit rubbish. You do kind of paint in a lot with your mind. So yeah, I'm right there with them. And I think that this is a good outcome for the Aztecs. I think it's a banger Dalek hybrid. I think that's about where it should sit. But it's going to sit higher in our final rankings than the Time Meddler. So take that, Doctor Who magazine.
Okay. Don't send your own Dalek Death Squad against us, or even your Aztec Death Squad. But in case you do, it's probably time for us to run back into our time machine and find out where we're going next by activating the randomizer.
That's right. Pausing only to pull in our pulley so that it isn't left behind us for our Dalek enemies to find. We enter the two components of the randomizer. The first one Pete has, it's the Codex, which is the list of all of Doctor Who in sequential order.
Indeed.
And Pete, how many stories have we yet to visit in our random adventure?
Well, that would be 207 out of 302. So there are 302 total Doctor Who stories, and we have 207 left to do.
We are racing here, racing to get to that 200 point before Doctor Who returns to our screens and adds more. Will we ever dip below 200? Wait and see.
not for a while after once they get started.
Not for a while. If we can get through just 7 more stories before whenever it is in November that we get the 60th anniversary first episode of Star Beast. Which we don't know yet, right? We still don't have a date.
Still don't have a date. They're true to pattern, we probably won't know until November.
Right.
Exactly what date it will be.
Well, in the meantime, we will choose somewhere between story 1, The Unearthly Child, and story 207 in our potential where to go, which is The Power of the Doctor. And we choose through the other part of the randomizer, random.org, the executor, which uses actual atmospheric randomness, atoms bouncing around the atmosphere, bits of the sun falling to Earth and embedding themselves in your heart. And that's how they achieve randomness. But we like to venerate the randomizer. We like to sacrifice one of ourselves, open up our hearts, as it were, metaphorically, and say, what do our hearts really want from the randomizer, from the god of randomness? Pete, what is your prayer?
Oh, you know, we've talked about it, and I'll just punctuate it. So we talked about the McCoy era and how little we've done, but I would also emphasize there are big swaths, seemingly anyway, but a big swaths of Doctor Who we haven't done. In other words, there are deserts in our codex where we just... there are big seasons we haven't done barely anything of. And so one of them is Matt Smith's era, even though we've done... Matt Smith has a lot of stories, so we've done a fair share of them, but there are a lot of stories that we haven't done there. And there's a big stretch from Victory of the Daleks to Curse of the Black Spot, which of course is our own curse. I won't go over that again, but there's a big, periods
for that. Yep.
Yeah. Big periods in our codex, that we don't have. So I'm saying, like, hey, give us either some McCoy or some Smith, please.
I like that. I'm going to dovetail with the second part of that, because I'm just going to make a naked appeal to the randomizers. Take us to New Who. And let me tell you why I'm risking the wrath of the randomizer by saying that. It comes down to one word: BritBox. 3 words: BritBox subscription increase. You may have gotten an email like I have saying they're going up to $8.99 a month.
Yeah.
And you have to actually agree to it if you're subscribed through Apple. And I'm not well disposed towards BritBox anyway for a number of reasons. We've talked about some of them in the podcast. Like, it's really hard to go from story to story. You know, to have to go out, go back in. The menu doesn't make a lot of sense. I could not watch their content in the UK, which is so weird.
Nonsensical.
Because I'm subscribed to American BritBox, so I couldn't watch British. But it just, you know.
You got to get your VPN.
Clearer. Yeah. Yeah, VPN in the UK to try and get into an American service to watch a British show. Anyway, so take us to New Who so I can spend some time, like, maybe without a BritBox subscription for a month. That would be nice.
All right. I don't know if that counts as a challenge or a tweet storm, but either way, we've got a couple challenges. It's either New Who or McCoy randomizer. So let us see what you have for us.
All right.
I'm going to give you a countdown. 4, 3, 2, 1.
I bring the obsidian blade down, and we're at 198.
Oh, yay. We are at 198?
Yes.
That's pretty late.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I was just thinking about this story. It's Kerblam.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Well, thank you. Thank you, randomizer.
Back to Jodie Whittaker.
Wow, the randomizer really loves that TARDIS team, huh? Yeah. Didn't we? I mean, we've had so much Graham and Yaz and Ryan. It's kind of unreal.
We've also had a lot of Amazon deliveries, if you're like me. So very apt. We're one day going to get to this.
Yeah.
And that day is next week, folks.
Yes.
But in the meantime.
Is approaching.
Yes. In the meantime, of course, you can subscribe to this podcast or get someone else to, because this is a podcast, everyone. This is Pull to Open. We have been your hosts, Pete Paschal.
And your host, Chris Taylor. Please follow us on Kablam Prime.
Yep. Can follow us on all the socials, Pull to Open 63 on most, Pull to Open on TikTok. Thanks to Martin West for all our music, particularly the new History Corner stuff.
Yes.
Good stuff, my man. And we want to get that Kerblam man and possibly sacrifice him.
Yes, rip out his heart and find out if it is, in fact, a cardboard package with a lot of bubble wrap inside.
All right, y'all. It's been real. Take it easy.
Find out soon. Take care, guys.